Hello and welcome to Knowledge Engage, the podcast from the University of Nottingham's Institute for Policy and Engagement. And also, welcome to the first in our series of COP26 themed episodes to mark the COP26 conference happening in just a couple of weeks' time. My name is Ben Sherwood, and today I'm joined by Jean Margerison. Now, Jean is an associate professor in the Faculty of Science here at the University of Nottingham, and she's a particular expert where it comes to dairy farming. And the main thing we're going to be talking about in this episode is how we might reduce the environmental impact of dairy farming, but we also touch on other topics such as animal welfare. Jean, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast. It's really exciting, everything going on with COP26 at the moment and the discussions we're having. And we're trying to talk to a lot of people about a range of topics. So firstly, I just wondered if you could tell me a little bit about how your research came about.
Well, to be honest, I'm actually from an agricultural background, and we had mixed livestock, and the animals I like the best were the dairy cows. And so it's been a love of a lifetime, really. I just adore dairy cows.
Oh, no, that's really good. So you've got this background in dairy farming. So I guess that's a topic quite close to your heart then, I take it.
It is, yeah. As I say, I come from a long family history of farming, and it's just one of those things that's in the blood, really. But as the animals go, yeah, I mean, dairy cows and pussycats are about my favourite things.
a very good combo. Okay, so I was wondering if you could tell me, like, through your research then, what do you think the key problems are that's facing the dairy industry at the moment in terms of reducing environmental impact? Because it's something that I've been seeing a lot of people talking about, the impact of dairy, the cost, the environmental cost of it, and the amount of space it takes up, etc. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, I suppose what you've got to remember is to get things in context a little bit. In essence, the surface of the planet, and very much in similar to the UK, 65% of it is not suitable to grow anything other than grass. And about half of that is the more productive sort of cultivated grass. And the other half of it is rough grazing. And even the rough grazing needs to be grazed in order to make that a better habitat for birds and wildlife, for them to be able to nest and breed. So it's quite interesting that a lot of it does need an element of control. You can't just not control it, because we would have less wildlife biodiversity if we did that.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that's not something I've heard many people talk about. People tend to focus on, yeah, what the negative things of, you know, as I said before, like the space it takes up. People don't tend to focus then on, as you say, like that need for some kind of control, like some controlled grazing. So that's a really interesting thing to hear, actually.
Yeah, I mean, this term that we have here is for conservation grazing. And so it uses ruminant livestock and some hindgut fermenters such as horses, depending on where you are. But it normally uses a combination of livestock to control that grass height to the correct level and the correct stocking rate of number of animals to the amount of space in order to achieve that. So it is important that we manage our environment, you know, well. The other areas that one of the main things that we have problems with, and while when we look at greenhouse gas emissions, agriculture is actually responsible for about 10%, with transport, production of energy and fuel combustion being the main contributors. So, but that doesn't mean we're not concerned about agriculture contributing that 10%. We certainly are. And we have fairly good measurements of how much different systems and different livestock contribute. And one of the main ones we're concerned about, of course, are these ruminant animals, because the majority of gases, you know, greenhouse gases are produced from that, you know, foregut ruminant fermentation called enteric fermentation. Yeah. And so, you know, we take full responsibility for that and are working on trying to lower that as much as possible. But bearing in mind that if we can't grow other crops and human edible, you know, food on that land, and we do have a great proportion of the UK, we are well placed from the point of view of soil type and climate for grass growth. And so therefore we need these ruminants to actually eat that to produce, you know, human food, really, because we can't actually go and eat or graze grass or even have it in the salad section, you know. I mean, and some of the work we're looking at is to say, to what extent can we alter land use? You know, can we, how much of it can we use for crops? But in reality, agricultural systems throughout the UK and other countries have evolved, you know, to best utilise the types of soils and regularity or lack of rainfall to suit the type of production, i.e. cropping, you know, as much as we can. And from that, we find that there's only a proportion of those crops are suitable for human consumption directly. And a lot of them are poorer quality and they're not suitable for human food production. So they're actually consumed by ruminants because they're unfit for human consumption.
Mm.
And the interesting thing is that ruminants don't just eat grass that we can't eat. They also eat other crops that we can't eat, such as forage maize crops. We grow that and we do that intentionally to actually lower methane emissions, because if we use a combination of grass and maize silage, we can actually lower methane emissions. And so that's the intention of doing that by having a better balanced diet for the ruminant.
That is really interesting. And yeah, not something again that I'd heard. I didn't realize that you have crop specific to lower the environmental impact. That's really interesting to hear.
Dairy cows, particularly in early lactation, need more energy. And so we're using maize silage to provide more starch, which is more energy for them. And those animals are far more feed efficient. And feed efficiency is another main driver. It is one of the main contributors to us reducing methane emissions. So we are using it, you know, these different diets in many, many ways in order to try and or to successfully reduce methane emissions. Not try. We are actually doing that without any problems at all.
Mm.
Another thing that's important that people don't realise is there's a lot of byproducts from human food processing, such as cereals and brewer's grains, so beverage industry byproducts, as well as food processing that creates, well, byproducts really that would normally be waste products. But interestingly enough, yet again, dairy cows or any ruminants can consume these, and dairy cows do consume a lot of these types of products, and they recycle those as well into milk, and obviously we use them in the beef industry as well to produce meat. So they're actually recycling things that otherwise would potentially end up in landfill, which of course is absolutely something you don't want to do.
Yeah, I like this mental image now of a cow being an organic recycler.
It's just a fact, it is.
Yeah,
you know?
That's really interesting.
And the reason I raised it is because, would you believe it yet again, if we use co-products, when we call them co-products, we used to call them byproducts, and they are a byproduct from an industry, that, you know, food and beverage and processing, but we now refer to them as co-products because they are so highly valuable in increasing the nutrient intake for ruminant animals, and it actually reduces the environmental carbon footprint of those diets. So it's amazing, you know, not only is it recycling those products, it's also doing so. And we can reduce the carbon footprint by using these feeds and methane emissions. In terms of methane emissions, and I hate to mention this at this juncture, but the manure that comes from these animals is actually invaluable as a source of nutrients that we manage well to prevent, you know, unnecessary methane loss from that and nitrate loss. And that adds, you know, back into the soil. It adds organic matter as well as nutrients, natural nutrients. We don't allow it to pollute the environment, but actually this manure is so valuable that farmers who are growing cereals that take nutrients out of the soil as well as organic matter, and it sort of turns into something akin to concrete, and it really isn't sustainable.
Yeah.
You have to start adding nutrients back and organic matter. And they, in fact, will take as much manure as any livestock farmer can produce in order to try and enhance their soil. So that's how valuable that is. And again, it's another example of how it's a whole recycling system that we have that means we have sustainability of food production and land management in the UK.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing then is that, yeah, a big part of this process is an understanding of the network amongst all of these different ways of farming, and how it's not just, okay, you've got dairy over here, you've got crops over here. It is all linked.
They are integrated. I mean, we often have, you know, traditionally we would have had mixed farming systems, and we have moved somewhat away from those purely because to get lower cost food for human consumption, you need to be efficient. And in some cases, you need to specialise. And so we have moved away from having dual purpose breeds. And this means we used to have British Friesians, and they're a dairy cow, but they were a dual purpose. And it was quite a blocky animal that produced a good beef carcass as well as milk. But in essence, in about the mid-70s, when people started to consume less meat and consume more milk in proportion, and milk prices are always relatively low because it's a global commodity, then we had to specialise. And so we started to use more of the Holstein Friesian, which is a specialised dairy breed from the States. Originally the same cow, but it was selected to be a specialised type of an animal. So some systems, it's better for it to be specialized from an economic point of view and the cost effectiveness of food provision for human consumption. And that is one of the cases. But I think another thing that people don't realize is that a large proportion of the beef that people consume actually is sourced from the dairy herd, because we actually crossbreed about half of the cows with a beef bull. And right. The offspring from that, because we only need in terms of herd replacements, we only need about 20% of the herd replaced each year. And we try and minimise that by, you know, good management from the point of view of cow comfort and lots of other things. We do put a lot of effort into managing animal health. And so the carbon footprint of beef coming from the dairy industry is substantially lower than it is from specialised beef production.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, which is, again, another thing people don't.
Yeah. So what I think we'll see, because we are looking at the whole carbon footprint through life cycle analysis, is that I think we are absolutely going to see changes in the farming systems that we have and land use. But we need to do that with a good set of information and models in order to look at what the impacts will be and have a look at what changes we can make to lower that carbon footprint, while making sure we've still got, you know, enough food production in the UK, particularly in areas where we naturally have a comparative advantage. In essence, we get rained on quite a lot.
We do.
Regularly. And that just spells grass growth, really. So it is one of our main comparative advantages. But it also limits, you know, what we can do with our land.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. Thank you for that. I guess, so the other area I want to talk about, because I know it's something that you've also looked into, is, and you've already hinted about the affordability of dairy produce and about improving the efficiency, bringing costs down and those kind of strategies for handling the economic cost. But I wondered if we could also talk about how we could make it affordable for the public in terms of those environmental impacts, but also animal welfare concerns, because I know that's a big thing people are talking about. So what can we do effectively put people's minds at ease?
Well, I'm absolutely, you know, going to make this very straightforward, that the UK has the highest welfare standards in the world. And it is amongst the countries, you know, that have higher standards in these production systems than other countries in the world. And so we can be very proud of being up there with the best of the countries with very high welfare standards. I'm glad to say that, you know, when we're looking at agricultural production, the provision of good standards of animal welfare and also management of animal health are very important factors in lowering methane emissions, because we want to make sure that we have healthy animals because they're the most productive. The two go together. There isn't, you know, sort of compromise there. And having less herd replacements, which I hinted at earlier on, and it is something I specialise in, looking at, you know, calf diets and management. We look at environmental enrichment. So, and we do look at animal behaviour, and it is an area that I research myself, where we actually look at cognitive development and play behaviour in calves and things that we need to add to that to make sure that they're very healthy, number one, and that they grow well, and that they also develop their cognitive abilities to socialise with different groups as they get older. And these are actually important elements. The other important elements are cow comfort, and we particularly emphasise on beds and space, and again, environmental enrichment for the adult animals to make sure that they have as long and as healthy life as possible. And I know this sounds all a bit trite, but actually it's not. If you ever talk to farmers, I think you'll find that their dairy cows really an extended family, to be honest.
And that's
you know, one of the things, I mean, I had two pet dairy cows when I was a child that, you know, had names, and I would spend a lot of time with them, and it's just, you know, an animal that I love to be with. So the opportunity, you know, to work with them and to improve their welfare and health is absolutely, you know, fantastic. And so our work tends to span quite a wide range of things. So it's not just all about productivity. I'm glad to say that, you know, good health, having a good environment in which to live that makes them comfortable. Yes, we do house them when the weather is inclement, and it would be it would do more environmental damage to leave them outside in the winter, and it would be not good animal welfare to do that either. So we do house them, but we only house them for as long as is sensible in terms of not damaging the soils and creating muddy conditions that are not suitable for them, and leaving them at the peril of, you know, unpleasant weather conditions that they're not, you know, not well suited in terms of thermal comfort zone to be outdoors. You do see some beef breeds that are outdoors during the winter, but it is a small proportion of those that are more hardy and don't grow as quickly and have a thicker coat and so on. And sheep, of course, have a thick woolly coat. You know, they're suited to that environment, whereas some of the others, it would not be good welfare to have a dairy cow out. So when we do house them, we want to make sure that we maximise the comfort, because this maximises the longevity and lifetime of those animals. And in essence, you know, it costs money to rear those, you know, to feed them prior to them producing milk or achieve, you know, their target age. And so it's important that we manage that well and we don't spend too much on that. And that when we've spent that money, we've made an investment, and then we want it to have as longer life and as comfortable a life as possible. And I know what's saying, as comfortable a life. Well, in essence, we want them, dairy cows lie down for almost half the day. And we want to make sure, it's true, it's 11 and a half hours. And we actually measure how long they lie down and use that as a measure of comfort.
Yeah.
And we do, yes, we are that interested in cows that we spend our time 24 hours a day monitoring what they actually do to make sure we're providing them with the best comfort. And more comfortable conditions means that they lie down for longer. And that's a good thing, because they're not doing nothing. They're actually ruminating, chewing on fibrous food that, you know, that makes grass and other forages something we can't digest.
That's really interesting. Thank you so much for that, Jean. Like, again, it really sounds like the way to think about this is just that it's all part of the same machine. It's all cogs in the same thing, and it all comes together to have the desired outcome. And actually, it sounds like whatever work is needed is actually relatively straightforward. And it's all coming together. So actually, it feels like a more like a public perception kind of thing.
The other thing to remember is that the farm assurance standards through which, you know, all our systems in the UK are monitored actually exceed animal welfare legislation. And we are very, you know, making great progress in terms of applying many things. And the other area of research that, you know, we really are, that's important to the UK, is that, you know, we use natural products. We don't use growth promoters, and we don't use antibiotics for anything other than, and we try and, you know, minimize, keep animals healthy, minimize any treatments. And we certainly don't use antibiotics for anything other than a small amount of animals where we do need treatment, just like humans would. It's absolutely no different. And the types of products we work on are natural products, and some quite interesting ones, you know, sort of like seaweed and linseed oil, oregano oil, yeasts. These types of things are the things that we will use to enhance the digestive tract and gut health of animals, to enhance their immunity. And in that way, you know, we are consciously trying to enhance their health, just like we would if we take supplements and things. We actually do this with these animals to avoid antibiotic use. Because as we all know from a human perspective, that if we have a healthier gut, then we've got a better immunity. Well, that's exactly what we're doing with both, you know, pre-ruminant, which are the baby calves, right through to, you know, adult cows. So there's some quite exciting work going on there. But the most exciting thing about it is, of course, now we have the technology to look at the microbiome. In fact, we have more microbiome data than we now have computing capacity in humanity to actually analyse.
Oh, wow.
So we have to select sections and so on. So it is an exciting time to be in this position to be able to have this information.
Yeah. So if people wanted to kind of follow up on this and read more, find out more, where would you recommend that they go to do that?
Well, it depends what they're interested in. And quite simply, whenever I'm looking at things, I know Google is a grey area in that some of the information in there is not particularly exact, but you can have a look at that. You can also have a look at some of these different things that have been, I've mentioned about looking at, and improving animal health. It's there really at your fingertips, and any of the scientific papers and research from the University of Nottingham on the website will give you a fairly good idea of what we're working on and what we found out.
Brilliant. I'll make sure there are some links in the description for those so people can find them if they want to. Is there anything else you wanted to just quickly add?
I suppose the only other thing is that one of the things that we are concerned about is people from a health benefit, people drinking nut milks because they are, generally speaking, not as nutritionally valuable because milk has a lot of amino acids. Some of those are those limiting and essential amino acids. It has a really good source of those. And these nut milks, by comparison, are very poor in terms of nutrition. And the other thing that concerns us is two things, is that milk, calcium in milk is in a micelle with protein in combination, so you can absorb that very well. And milk's incredibly important for bone and teeth health. And we're particularly concerned about young females consuming nut milks because it doesn't build strong bones and teeth, and particularly, you know, if they're going to have children and through menopause, of course, two quite challenging points in your lifetime as a female in terms of bone health. Of course, is, you know, when we look at the Eat Well and Lancet diet, dairy, you know, is in there in three portions a day, veg is five, and sugar, you know, they're trying to limit sugar. So you're getting a dose of sugar that you weren't expecting. So
We
are looking at agricultural systems to try and reflect that in terms of how we best provide good nutrition and food at a price where, you know, that everybody can afford to eat a healthy diet. That very much concerns us.
Yes. Yeah, I think that is going to be a big part of it, that affordability.
Absolutely.
Obviously, yeah, they're economic, but also, you know, the people who have the concerns about the welfare, and people who are, you know, people who are vegan, they're gonna obviously favour the nut milks, etc. as well.
Yeah.
But it's a very fair point that they are, like, a lot of them are full of a lot of sugar.
And even if they're not full of sugar, they don't provide those amino acids and fatty acids you need, and the calcium is not bioactive. You don't absorb any added calcium very well. Because, as I say, the calcium in milk comes in this micelle. It comes with fixed in the protein so that you can absorb it. So it's not the same, even if you look at the amount. It's more bioavailable, so it's very, very different. So actually looking at the calcium level on its own, comparison of different nut milks, doesn't actually give you a true picture at all of that bioavailability.
Thanks again to Jean, and thank you for listening to this episode of Knowledge Engaged. Do look in the description to this episode where you'll find all the links mentioned earlier in the episode. And also keep an eye out for more episodes coming up over the coming days and weeks for more COP26 related content. Thank you.